Energy Transition, episode number 49. Our topic today is a big oops for big oil. Thank you, Irina, for this suggestion for the title.
I know we should thank David. He came up with the blog post about it.
Let me share with you, please. David wrote an article last week with the title, BP CEO could start by simply saying, oops. What's happening with BP? I'm not sure it's only with BP. Let's start with David, please.
Well, it's probably not only with BP, but BP is the most prominent example of an oil company that over the last few years, since Bernard Looney became the CEO in, 2020, Irina noted that when he took the job, he said that going heavily into renewables was the only path forward for his company in the energy transition. And, he made some lofty promises about spending as much as $5 billion a year in investing in wind and solar and other energy transition kinds of projects. And last week, the Wall Street Journal published an article that, if it's accurate, indicates Mr. Looney is having second thoughts. And good for him. That's to his credit. His company's performance has lagged well behind that of Exxon and Chevron in terms of stock price performance and profitability over the last few years. I think the statistics I noted in that piece I wrote was that BP stock price since January 2021 has risen by only 7%. ExxonMobil's has tripled during that same period of time. Chevron's up by 80% during the same period of time. So, these companies all compete against one another for projects and investments all over the world. And when your performance is lagging as badly as BP's has since Looney took over, it does kind of demand that you rethink your strategy. And BP has its earnings call tomorrow for 2022 in the fourth quarter of 2022. And Mr. Looney is expected to announce some level of a change of course during that call. So we'll see what happens tomorrow.
Irina, in the same matter, same topic, why Exxon and BP, they have so different forecasting for oil demand for 2050? Do you have some idea about that?
I think, I can only speculate, of course, because I don't know anybody at BP who could tell me, something more accurate. But this is not the first time BP has forecast the demise of oil demand. They said this in the 2019 energy outlook. They said that we're past peak oil demand days. And then they basically had to say we were wrong because oil demand continued to grow despite the pandemic. Now they are once again saying in their outlook that what is it? Are we past peak oil demand or we're about to witness it? They are simply betting on it. They're not impartial commentators and forecasters of oil demand because of their, bet on renewables. They have a vested interest in convincing people that oil demand is going to decline, while Exxon, which, as David has repeatedly pointed out, American oil companies are more realistic and they're more, they're more attached, so to speak, to their core business. So they're making forecasts in line with their long-term strategy, I suppose. They're not so heavily invested in renewable energy. But I would like to add something to what David said about Bernard Looney's report about Bernard Looney. And the Wall Street Journal quoted sources from BP as saying that he's worried because some wind and solar investments are underperforming expectations. That's the problem. Yeah, shocking, really. Nobody could have seen this coming. And the fact that there are so many reports that have emerged recently about, well, shall we say, challenges in the build out of wind and solar installations, I'm beginning to think there is truth to that report.
But Tammy, do you believe that they are under pressure? I mean, CEOs are scared. What kind of a fear they could have? Why they are so unstable?
That's a very good question, especially given, you know, when I looked at the BP outlook this year, it reminded me of the IEA and how before they used to be fairly reliable, you know, and now it's just this really strange projection of wanting a certain outcome and hoping that maybe they can shift that outcome or shape that outcome based on this data that they're generating. Like the BP outlook had three scenario analyses, and the one was if they go full net zero, and the other one was if it's kind of reduced net zero. And then I forget, they had a funny name for a third one, where it kind of showed things just going like this and maybe up a little bit. But in their net zero scenario, it's like this. And you have to ask yourself, all right, so are they betting on the fact that the Western countries have said that they're going to ban the internal combustion engine, which of course then would lower the demand for oil. And so they're kind of factoring that into their scenarios, but it's like they don't take into account developing countries. It's like they don't exist, that, you know, that India and China aren't going to be increasing anything, but everything's going to be going down in the West. And so therefore their numbers are adjusted accordingly, which then brings it to the point about the CEOs and, you know, what are they afraid of? Well, the EU has just put forward its climate-related financial accounting stuff. The ISSB is about to announce theirs in about a month or two. The SEC, despite that Wall Street Journal article, they're just going to shift it to consumer tracking instead of business tracking for the moment. So they see the writing on the wall to some extent that this is where governments want to take things. And they feel like, I think, many big companies, that if they're not playing that game, that they're going to be left out or discriminated against or any one of those things.
Yep. Irina, what are the options for this big oil? I mean, they should, let's say, concentrate on oil and gas. They should concentrate in renewables. They should make a mix of them. What is the thought for? What are the thoughts for that?
Well, based on the assumption that big oil companies are still companies that exist in order to make a profit, I would say that, well, you never know. Yeah. but based on this assumption, if we make this assumption, I would suggest that it would be most rational for them to try and play, you know, both games. I mean, continue producing oil and gas because clearly the world needs oil and gas. And the record profits of 2022 are, you know, pretty good evidence that this is the case. But hedge their bets with some renewable energy investments, taking advantage in the process of all those government subsidies that are going to be thrown at them. And indeed, Tammy, I think she made a very, very good point about discrimination. If you do not play the renewable energy game, you might get, you know, you might lose access to all the subsidies that you could otherwise get your hands on.
You seems ugly.
Yeah.
David, suppose you are the BP CEO from now. What are your decisions?
Ooh, that's a really good question. I, you know, they've they've gone really heavily into to renewables. And you know, if Mr. Looney really is disappointed in the profits they're generating or the losses, then yeah, he's going to have to change course. You know, when you really look at the different approaches that each of the majors has had to this, you see the companies with an outlook like Exxon's of rising oil demand, you know, that only starts to level off around 2040 and 2050, investing in projects related to the kinds of energy transition initiatives that fit the staff they already have on hand, the scientists and the engineers and geologists. You know, they're already staffed up in a way that easily makes it much easier for them as a company to pursue things like carbon capture and storage, geothermal projects, hydrogen manufacturing projects, which is very fit for their downstream operations. You know, these kinds of things that number one, serve to lower your company's own emissions profile, scope one and scope two, which is what Exxon and Chevron are focused on. And number two, becomes a profit, a project that can be very profitable. I mean, ExxonMobil's talking about, well, they're not just talking about it, they're executing on a project in which the overall investment is going to be $100 billion in capturing and storing carbon emissions for the tailgates of all these plants along the Houston Ship Channel, not just their own plants, but other companies' plants, in these depleted oil reservoirs up and down the Texas and Louisiana Gulf Coast. And it's going to be a highly profitable business venture for them. And by the way, it also qualifies for the tax incentives in the Inflation Reduction Act. So, you know, they were very successful in lobbying Congress to include that kind of a project as qualifying for these tax incentives, not necessarily the subsidies that are more specific to wind and solar and batteries. But there is that investment tax credit, which is a big deal for companies in this industry. And, you know, BP might want to think about, you know, actually pursuing the kinds of projects they're staffed up to pursue already, rather than going out and investing in wind and solar and battery operations that require the building of an entirely different kind of staff with different kinds of expertise. And, you know, it's just a matter of philosophy and whether you can make it work for your company and its performance. And I think what we've seen with BP is that it just hasn't worked out the way Mr. Looney thought it would.
If I could just add to that, I know that BP is working on a massive carbon capture storage project in the UK, and that they've run into some difficulty because the government allowed BP, gave them permissions to store it in the North Sea. But at the same time, they gave permissions for wind turbines to be built in the same place. And so now they're fighting over who gets access because they didn't take into account what would be the effect of the vibrations and everything else of the wind turbines, you know, anchored to the floor where they're going to be injecting the CO2. So now it's before the courts deciding who gets it first kind of thing. And which has kind of thrown a monkey wrench into BP's planning because they've spent a lot of money on the initial phases, you know, the engineering, the cost benefit analyses and so on. And they're getting ready to try and build something. And now there's this dispute over who actually gets access to the North Sea floor.
Think how many years it's going to take to resolve that conflict in the courts. Yeah. Holy
good God. Question. Who knows, right?
Yeah, Irina, but these thoughts are the same for both companies. I mean, for BP and Exxon, with so different forecasting.
This what, sorry?
I mean, this thoughts that David and Tammy brought to us are the same for BP and for Exxon, for instance?
Well, not really. Basically, European big oil majors are under a lot more pressure than American oil majors from governments and from all sorts of institutions, even from climate activists. I mean, Europe is the mecca of climate activists. However much, you know, American climate activists try to compete with that. So when the pressure is greater, I mean, you're more likely to succumb eventually, especially if you get sued, as Shell did. And I assume BP and Total Energies do not want to get sued, so they are pursuing these renewable energy projects on a much bigger scale than Exxon and Chevron. But thinking about carbon capture, I'm sure you've noticed that climate activists and environmentalists are really opposed to this. They're saying it's too expensive, it doesn't work, it's a bad decision. I just had this thought, based on no evidence, no factual evidence at all, that they may be opposed to it because it actually does work.
Yes, because exactly.
Why would companies such as Exxon spend so much, and BP, as Tammy noted, why would they spend so much money on carbon sequestration if it's really so expensive, unprofitable, and ultimately doesn't work? So I think that's
they don't. There. That's a really good point. The activists don't like it because it allows the companies to continue to exist,
right?
And it allows people to continue using oil and gas.
Yeah.
And if you follow any of these movements, like the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty, which is insane, but they want to treat oil and gas and coal like nuclear weapons, and they've gotten some really big cities and regions to sign on to this, where they're pledging that they're going to get rid of it. Toronto signed on to it. I'm like, I'm still waiting for them to stop using the natural gas since they signed on to it, you know? But I mean, it's a bit disturbing to see that they want to treat something that is so useful to our modern technological society as if it's a nuclear weapon. It beggars belief, actually, but they just don't want it, which is why they're so against carbon capture. And they put out all of these myths like, it's going to contaminate the water and it's not going to stay in the reservoir. And oh my gosh, it's going to be polluting the soil and ruin biodiversity. I mean, they have no clue, but they say it, hoping it gets out there to scare people, just like they did with fracking.
Well, and that's a very successful strategy for the climate alarmists. Mm-hmm. I mean, because so many media outlets will just take what they say and quote it and put it in their articles because it, you know, gives them 100 words for their stories without any critical analysis at all. And that happens all the time in the American media, the Western media all over the world. And so, yeah, I mean, they can just say the most ridiculous things and it ends up on the front page of the New York Times quite often without any critical analysis or the writer seeking any comment from someone else that might refute all that. But it's really true that the main reason the activists oppose carbon capture is because it's a way for oil companies to stay in business. And this is the other thing I forgot to mention early on, is that the other part of BP's strategy, and Shell is also going down the same path, is a pretty dramatic reduction in their company's oil production over the next decade as a means of lowering their emissions profile as well. And as y'all say, a lot of that's been driven by the courts. I mean, the court decision against Shell in the Netherlands essentially orders the company to reduce its oil production in the coming years. Well, Exxon and Chevron aren't doing that. I mean, they're working, endeavoring to increase their oil production because they see, their analysts see oil demand globally increasing. It's why Saudi Arabia, Aramco, is planning a very dramatic increase in its own drilling program in the coming years to help meet that global demand, because these are the countries, along with Russia, if it can ever get back online, assuming this war ever ends, that have spare capacity to add to global supply to meet that demand. And so it's just, you know, these companies are taking really divergent paths, and one's been rewarded by investors and the other hasn't so far?
You see, the windmills fails. What exactly is happening? I'm not aware about this. I mean, it's something rare, right? Or it's common?
Well, it's not that common. I mean, it's not like every second windmill in a wind park is failing, but they are falling down, and there are problems with component failures, whatever this means, because I read Siemens Gamesa's financial statement, which mentions component failures without going into detail. It would have been surprising if they did go into detail. But these failures are affecting their profits, their financial performance. And it might become a serious problem, because the impression I'm being left with from reading reports about wind energy, recent reports, is that they are making bigger, taller, bigger turbines constantly, and they're doing it faster and faster. They're ramping up production very fast in response to government-motivated demand growth. And this is naturally leading to problems with quality. So these problems, I suspect, might very well become more frequent, and continue affecting BP's renewable energy business performance, and not just theirs.
And it's a big deal when those towers fall down. Some of those things are 700 feet tall. I mean, this is not just your farm windmill falling over in a storm. It's a major event when one of these things collapses. And the problem wind has. It's why I continue to believe that eventually the world will move more with solar, because it's so much more versatile than wind is. Wind's main innovation, and really the only thing available to it, is to keep going higher and higher, capturing the higher wind speeds at higher altitudes. And if you can't figure out how to do that without keeping the things from toppling over, well, then you've got a real problem. And it's just such a limited technology in reality, and it's just taking the world a while to realize that.
Yeah, that's right. And so that's the reason they are looking for offshore windmills. I mean, to be close to some platform, and to put energy directly to there. Do you know something about the offshore windmills?
I don't know. I think Ørsted just took a write down on one offshore wind project in the US, but I didn't go into details because I didn't have time. So there are problems with offshore too. For starters, it's much more expensive to develop. And now there seem to be problems. Well, they're not new problems, but now they are surfacing problems with wait times for connection to the grid. It's the same problem for both wind and solar.
Yeah. Yeah.
Companies have to wait for years to get connected to get a final approval to get connected to the grid. And in the UK, the wait times are up to 13 years, according to a Financial Times report. And one, I forget if it was a solar or wind power developer, probably wind power since it's the UK, he said no company can afford to leave a project waiting for 13 years. But I understand the perspective of the grid operators. If you are going to be getting a lot of intermittent power, you have to, somehow plan.
Right.
You can't rush this. And one wonders, did nobody think about this? And the answer, I think, is no, nobody thought about this.
Yeah, there's such a rush. There's such a frenzy to feed off of these incentives and subsidies, right? That you want to make those investments immediately and go into those projects as fast as you can, because it helps you collect more money from the government. And that's a problem with any industry that's based on the seeking of government rents. It distorts the market. It causes business decisions that are not based in economics or are real business principles. And you end up with these kinds of distortions. And, you know, it's just amazing. I was talking with someone else this morning, amazing watching all of this happen over and over. Our societies make the same mistakes over and over and over again throughout my whole lifetime. It never ends, I guess.
I think what's frustrating is that there's, thanks, Doug. That's a really good point. And so what they're doing now for Siemens Gamesa is that BlackRock, Vanguard, and all those other big investment firms that invested in that company and lost this money, Siemens AG is going to buy it out wholesale. Yeah. So Siemens AG owns 51%, but they're going to be buying up the rest of it now. So, which makes me wonder, is Vanguard and State Street and all those guys, are they going to get their money out of it? Like, what, or are they going to have to absorb that loss? I mean, it's an interesting question about how they shuffle all this money around. And Is Siemens AG getting money from the German government in order to ensure that they absorb that renewable aspect into the larger Siemens group? I don't know. It's a bit interesting that they're saying that they need more government certainty. Certainty more government and
We need more government commitments in financial form.
They expect a government interference in those projects.
They can't do it on their own, which David and I, and I'm sure Tammy, have been saying for years.
So this is what's frustrating, is that people make this case to the policymakers. They make the case to the politicians. It's not like they're not getting that information, but it's like they just don't care. They just don't care. And they have this tunnel vision and they go in that direction and nothing seems to be able to dissuade them from it, even though, you know, people are losing money.
Just one more reason why having politicians make these decisions is the worst situation possible, because they don't know anything about any of this. And they're the ones making all the policy and passing all the big bills and distorting all the markets. And these are the outcomes. They're entirely predictable and should be entirely expected.
That's right.
But the big investors don't seem to know any better either. Like, for example, the Canada Pension Plan Investment Fund, they've invested in Octopus Energy, which is the UK one, and they have facilities in other countries and whatnot. And Octopus Energy bragged about how they've never made a profit. They've never made a profit. And on their website, they were going on about how they needed an infusion of cash. So the Canada Pension Plan gave them $252 million to keep them afloat. Well, what are pension investors getting out of this? A company that never makes a profit.
Yeah. Right. It's not their money and they have no ramifications for poor decisions. Yeah, exactly.
That's right. That's right. That's right. Totally right. Okay, guys. The conclusion is that you are similar to a airport windsock in a stormy day, so with no direction. And now
I still like the wind turbines running on the diesel generators. I thought that was so hilarious this morning.
I really appreciate y'all.
Great point. Using diesel generators, my god. David wrote an article for that, no, today?
Yeah, David? Yeah, it's my energy absurdity of the day.
Oh, that was so great.
It was. It's like going to the local Starbucks to recharge your electric car and then walking around behind the building and realizing that there's a diesel generator back there powering the electric recharger, you know, just on a bigger scale.
But zero emissions.
Running, just to avoid them freezing, not to produce electricity.
That's zero emission, right?
Totally.
Thank you so much. And please, people, do not forget to follow David at Energy Absurdity, Irina at Slav Energy, the nimetreport.com and kavaya.com. Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. Y'all have a wonderful week.
Have a great day and great week.
Have a good day. Bye-bye.
Yeah. Bye. Bye.